Hey, Penknife listeners, if you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts, subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and, of course, tell your friends about it. Thank you.
I wake up, I look around. No, I'm not awake, I'm still dreaming. What I just saw was a whitewashed room with an iron grill on one of its sides. That is something out of my dream. I lie there with my eyes shut, try to remember. Something happened in the night that my left hand remembers. Quite involuntarily, it gropes about the floor, and now it encounters the cool smoothness of glass. It raises the bottle to my mouth, and I drink again. With my eyes shut, I drink Black Forest plum brandy again. I am with Elinor again. I am with Elinor. Life is beginning again. I swing myself higher. I've only been asleep for a short time, and I'm with Elinor again. 2-3 mouthfuls, and now the bottle is empty. I suck at it. Not another drop comes. With a deep sigh, I put it down, and once again I open my eyes. I see a whitewashed cell, rather dirty, with many inscriptions and obscene drawings scratched on the walls. Very high up one wall, where it begins to slope, a small barred window. This window is open. Through the opening, I see a pale blue, feebly sunlit sky. On its fourth side, this cell has a strong iron-barred grill, exactly like the bars of cages in the zoo. Outside the grill is a stove, then a door, which is shut. I am imprisoned. I look at my bed. I am lying in my clothes on a miserable iron bedstead, on a straw bag with a torn blanket. My cell also contains a table, a stool, and a terrible stinking bucket. Yes, and the bottle, which I have just emptied. I spring from my bed. I hold the bottle up to the light. There really isn't a drop in it. Finally, I put it away behind the bucket, and while I am doing so, something of the night's experiences returns.
My name is Corey Eastwood, and I'm a writer and bookseller. While I've never woken up from a blackout in jail, I have done so in some unpleasant places, such as prostrate on the sidewalk in front of my all-night book table in Greenwich Village.
My name's Ramona Stout, and I'm a writer who has also never had the pleasure of waking up from a blackout in jail, or on a New York City sidewalk, but rather on a beach covered in cuts made by sharp rocks, being licked by a strange dog, and wearing someone else's clothes.
And I'm Santiago Lemoine, the writer and bookseller. And I once woke up in an empty bathtub with my skull cracked open and covered in my own blood. The worst part, though, was being late to work and getting fired. In any case, this is Penknife, a podcast about writers who may or may not have written about crime, but who definitely committed it. There are few worse experiences in life than waking up in strange places from a blackout with that question to which there's no good answer, just varying degrees of bad. That question that enters your hungover brain in a whisper, but is soon your own personal rave, pounding harder than your headache. What the hell did I do to land me here?
Hans Fallada was clearly very experienced in this sensation. He'd failed to kill himself during his many teenage efforts, but with alcohol he achieved regular, sometimes daily, self-obliteration.
The bit we just heard wasn't our writing, nor was it from one of Fallada's memoirs. It's a passage from his novel The Drinker, a highly, highly autobiographical passage that closely parallels an event in his own life.
Ironically, it's probably a lot more true to life than the last book he published in the Third Reich, which was his 1942 memoir titled Our Home Today. The book is all about his idyllic country life and happy family in Karbitz. Covers much of his adulthood and yet boldly manages to leave out the addictions, affairs, jails, sanatoria, and general misery and desperation that marked most of his life.
After Our Home Today, he basically gives up trying to write and busies himself with alcoholism and affairs with younger women. Periodically, he makes grand resolutions and proclamations that he's going to moderate and change his ways, but they're all short-lived at best.
On top of that, the situation in Germany is deteriorating as the war drags on and the tide begins to turn against the Axis. By the fall of 1942, Allied planes are flying over the Fallada farm in Karwitz on a regular basis on their way to bomb Berlin.
A few months later, with the devastating defeat in Stalingrad now imminent, the Nazis acknowledge their first military failure, and Falada's buddy Goebbels proclaims a new phase of total war, which means if you're a male aged 16 to 65 and you're not already involved in the war effort, it's time to lace up your boots.
Instead of going to war, though, Falada goes deeper into alcoholic depression, then checks himself into another sanatorium.
The sanatorium, which clearly enjoys welcoming him back a la today's rehab mills, manages to sober him up. But as soon as he leaves, he gets right back to the business of boozing and womanizing. He has a number of affairs with young women, including his typist and his maid. When Seuss finds out about the latter, Falada leaves the house and he and the maid move into the barn.
This is the last straw for Seuss, and finally, they apply for divorce. She charges him with having extramarital affairs, and his reason for divorcing her is, quote, refusing marital relations and further offspring.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry, but we really need to stop here and have a look at this. Jesus Christ. Can you imagine a worse crime against humanity than refusing further offspring from a degenerate junkie alcoholic criminal in the midst of a world war where your country, which happens to be perpetrating the Holocaust, is now being blanketed in bombs? Refusing marital relations and further offspring from the great Hans Falada. I mean, how could this woman ever live with herself again?
A bad wife, if ever there was one.
When the divorce is finalized in the summer of 44, Falada is in great spirits. The maid is long gone, but so be it. He's met a younger, hotter, and richer woman who's more fun and more unstable.
Every fool's dream. In the Jenny Williams biography on Falada, the young woman in question, Ulla, is referred to as, quote, not only physically attractive, but sexually available. I mean, come on. What 50-year-old drunken scumbag writer wouldn't fall for her?
She's basically the archetype of the femme fatale, the perfect woman for an asshole like Falada to blame for his troubles. She's 22 years old, and though she grew up working class, as a teenager, she got a job selling soap and married her boss. He died leaving her a child and plenty of cash. And when she meets Hans in 1944, she's not afraid to show it. She walks around the farming village rocking curls, makeup, bright red nail polish, and jewelry.
Which is basically scandalous in Nazi Germany.
And lucky drunky Hans cannot get enough.
Sure, it's got happy ending written all over it. He's gonna get together with a woman less than half his age, who also happens to be a big fan of his old friend Morfin. It's gonna be all wine and roses.
Well, there's actually plenty of wine and roses. Too much, in fact.
Hans is still more or less living on the farm in Karbitz with his ex-wife while he begins his new relationship with Ulla. I say more or less because he's also staying elsewhere and because he's living in an alcoholic haze. Along with courting Ulla, his favorite thing to do in this period seems to be to get rip-roaring drunk, throw tantrums, and terrorize all those who have the misfortune to be around him.
On August 28, 1944, it's Seuss who has that misfortune. During a fight in the kitchen, he brandishes a pistol and fires it.
Whether or not it's aimed at Seuss, it misses. She quickly wrestles it from him and pistol whips his ass. While he sits licking his wounds, she ends the matter by going and heaving the gun into the lake.
Well, it doesn't end there, actually. In no time, word of the incident travels throughout the town, and Hans is arrested and charged with attempted manslaughter.
Not a bad addition to his criminal resume. 33 years after his murder charge, he's booked again with attempted manslaughter.
Accounts differ as to whether or not he aimed at Seuss. Apparently, she went to her grave refusing to say if he deliberately shot at her. But most biographers claim that he did not aim in her direction, and that the gun might have gone off accidentally.
Regardless, it's enough to land him in the Strelitz State Mental Hospital, where he's housed among other, quote, mentally deranged criminals.
Okay, so this is the truth behind the passage that started the episode.
Well, the situation described in the novel The Drinker is fictionalized, but it's not much of a stretch to think that he did wake up in jail in a similar situation, longing for alcohol and his new love, Ulla, as he remembered the events that led him there.
The Drinker is a first-person story of Irvin Sommer, a respectable businessman who one day gains a taste, then a thirst, and then an inexhaustible need for alcohol. In short time, he destroys his company and his marriage. He gets kicked out of his home and is living for the bottle and a local barmaid, Eleanor, who's clearly a stand-in for his new main squeeze, Ulla. His self-destructiveness and self-hatred is matched by his animosity towards his stable, respectable wife, who's obviously a stand-in for Seuss. The fight with her, where he threatens her life, lands him in jail, though it's worth noting that in the fictional version, there's no gun involved. He then gets moved to an insane asylum, where at the end of the novel we learn that he's infected himself with the mucus of tuberculosis patients, and he's relating the story of his downfall as he waits for his suicide to come to pass.
Jesus Christ, that sounds bleak.
It is, and it's absolutely brilliant. And I've been teasing throughout the season saying that while each of his books is great, apart from those published during the Third Reich, that none of them were my favorites, this one gets pretty close. I'd call it my second favorite Falada novel, and an all-time classic in the genre of books about alcoholism.
And yet, I don't think I'm alone in not having heard of it until you came to us with the idea of covering Falada.
Well, that's just because of Lucky Hans's rotten luck. I mean, in my opinion, it's better than Charles Jackson's classic novel on alcoholism, The Lost Weekend. That book came out in 1944 at a time in the U.S. when society was beginning to view alcoholism as a disease. And for that reason, and because John Huston turned it into a great film, it was a huge hit. But Falada's novel was written in 44 and not published until 1950.
So you're saying that whereas Falada's timing was perfect for Little Man, he was a bit late for The Drinker.
Yeah, and I suppose Germany in 1950 had other things on its mind.
Well, alcoholic classic or not, it sounds like it's definitely a classic in the genre of desperate literature.
Ah yes, my favorite genre. You know, a few hundred years ago, my friend Michael McCann and I used to have a blog by that name, where we reviewed books that dealt with the subject of desperation, and incidentally, in 2014, we recycled the name when we opened a bookstore in Madrid and called it Desperate Literature.
Ah yeah, I think I've been there. Not the best shop in Spain, but not horrible either. I've seen worse. No, I'm just kidding. Go pay a visit. You won't regret it.
I see what you mean by calling The Drinker desperate literature, and I like it as a genre. But then again, desperation is an emotion or state of being that can be found in pretty much all great literature, no? I think it's the vehicle for most plots, actually. A character is inspired into action by finding themselves in a desperate situation. At its core, it's the survival instinct, the individual or collective struggle rooted in the fear of death. And then it gets wrapped up in, say, ego, pride, insecurity, or art, politics, or love, and the desperate engine can power all kinds of different plots.
It's funny that one of the most annoying questions we get in the bookshop is, can you recommend a novel that's inspiring? And whenever someone asks that, usually what they want is The Alchemist or Siddhartha. But to me, inspiration in fiction pretty much always goes hand in hand with sincere desperation. Some of the most inspiring novels I've ever read, like Hamsun's Hunger or Bolaños the Savage Detectives, are moving because the characters are always acting in states of desperation. And I'm not talking about despair, which is giving up or resignation, but good old-fashioned emotional, physical, and spiritual desperation. People who are desperate to live, and it's their refusal to give up that makes the struggle so affecting.
We joke about the 200 cigarettes a day, but think about it. Can you imagine the anxiety that must provoke? That amount of nicotine pumping through your body, the nervous energy and constant need for more? Even as a smoker, I find it nearly impossible to imagine. But reading The Drinker, it's as if you're right there with Falada and a few thousand milligrams of nicotine in your bloodstream as you make terrible misstep after terrible misstep. But unlike his narrator, the reader sees it all coming, and half the time you want to scream at the book, stop, don't do it. For me, being so close to a person who's self-destructing in that way made for a difficult read.
Yeah. It's interesting because Falada's character in The Drinker is not a very sympathetic person. Even before he begins his alcoholic descent into the abyss, he's weak, selfish, lazy, and insecure. Add booze to that mix and he becomes abusive and criminal. Throughout it all, though, through the most plain-spoken narration of all of his horrible actions, you get the feeling he doesn't like what he's doing, that he desperately wants to but is incapable of living differently. And I like that Santi got us on this desperation kick, because I think that's the force that drives and unites all of Falada's novels and his life's actions as well.
Yeah, even though most of his work isn't in the first person, it all shares that quality. You're with a character who's struggling, who despite himself makes choices which make his situation worse. There's something about it, about watching these characters suffer, that inspires a great amount of empathy.
There's probably a German word for it, like the opposite of Schadenfreude.
Yeah, it's called empathy, right? Not taking pleasure in others' misfortune and instead identifying with their struggle.
Okay, but it doesn't sound German.
Yeah. And I'd take it a step further and say that desperation, when described honestly, is uniquely empathy-inducing. I mean, I can read about a character being depressed, being in love, or excited, and if it's well-written, and depending on my mood, I can relate and maybe even experience my own emotions in new ways through the lens of the book. But there's something particularly visceral and immediate about desperation, which is why, I think, it's easier to convey in writing than, say, love or melancholy. Even if the character is a bad guy and a criminal, like, for instance, the talented Mr. Tom Ripley, you feel for him because regardless of how many people he killed to get there, his situation is desperate, and you can't help but root for him to get out of his jam. And when a character isn't a psychopath, but someone relatable in his flaws and fallibility like Falada's drinker, then his downfall is that much more unnerving.
Well, not everyone likes the book as much as you. When it's finally found amongst his papers and published posthumously in 1950, Falada's buddy and fellow teenage suicide attempt survivor, Johannes Becher, who we heard about in episode one, writes, quote, "It's a wholly unnecessary book, harmful and repellent, with no human insights, no literary appeal, a pity."
That's funny. The Sunday Times says it's, quote, "heroic, brave, fearless, and honest. It's necessary reading."
Oh, there you go again, calling books important or necessary. I'm sorry. I love novels as much as or more than the next person, but I'm not going to tell you that a single one of them is necessary.
Well, the necessary debate aside, I love that it's called brave, fearless, and heroic, because it's the work of a self-described coward, whose stand-in in the book is probably even more cowardly than Falada himself. And yet I wholeheartedly agree. To be this unabashedly honest about one's own degradation and depravity is heroic. And as far as having no literary appeal and saying nothing about the human condition, that's absolutely nonsense. It's written in simple prose, sure, but who made the rule that a straightforward style can't be just as illuminating and profound as Joyce or Wolfe?
Well, Falada's style has always been straightforward and naturalistic, but if this one feels a bit more raw, unaffected, and unedited, there's a good reason for that. He writes it in the Nazi insane asylum while doing his time for threatening Susie's life.
This is a different lockup than the last one where Hans did time in 1928. Now the Nazis are in charge, and things haven't quite panned out like the BS forward Falada wrote for Once a Jailbird would make you believe they would have, i.e., things have not gotten better.
Not quite, no, and especially not in psychiatric prisons. Remember that, along with carrying out the Holocaust, the Nazis are also responsible for history's largest eugenics program, in which they sterilize and murder people with mental and physical disabilities.
Actually, which eugenics program was the biggest is up for debate. Yes, the Nazis probably killed the most people, but let's not forget that the highest number of sterilizations took place in the early 20th century in the land of freedom, your country, Corey, where about 70,000 people were forcibly sterilized for being poor, disabled, and or non-white.
It's true, Hitler got a lot of his ideas about eugenics from the US. And in the Nuremberg trials, a lot of Nazis defended not only the killing of the disabled, but also the Jews, gypsies, and everyone else they mass murdered as being part of the same race purification scheme that had been widely accepted in the US.
It's horrible. And keep in mind, this is 1944. In Auschwitz, they're gassing 6,000 Jews a day. Institutional concern for human life and the lives of those deemed undesirable has probably never been lower in the history of the world. The Nazis have been sterilizing and euthanizing alcoholics, drug addicts, and people they labeled criminally insane, i.e. people like Falada, for years now.
But Hans locks out again. Because he's only admitted for observation, without a fixed term, he's not a candidate for euthanasia.
But if the Nazis would have any idea how he's spending his time in prison, they would kill him on the spot.
And what he's doing, the horrible, treacherous, punishable by death activity that our Hans is engaging in, is, of course, writing.
In the months leading up to his arrest, he'd managed to convince Goebbels to give him an advance for a novel he claimed he was going to write about the famous Kutusker Barmat scandal, which was a fraud case from the 1920s that involved two Jewish financiers. It was used by the anti-Semitic right to promote their brand of hate, and for that reason, Goebbels was more than happy to grant Falada an advance to work on a novel about it. Finally, Hans Falada would write the great anti-Semitic novel of the 1940s.
Except that no, he wouldn't, because he never intended to. Knowing that the Nazis' days were numbered as they were losing the war, and also just being hard up for cash and therefore willing to promise anyone anything, he never had any intention of writing an anti-Semitic novel. In fact, anti-Semitism was something that he, privately at least, always stood against.
But the novel in progress is the perfect excuse to request a pen and paper while in the psych prison.
Yep. Though he hardly even bothers to feign work on that novel. Instead, in a script so tiny it's essentially indecipherable, he writes a children's story. And from there, he goes directly on to write The Drinker.
I guess he's figuring that either the Nazi guards will be bored by the children's story and stop reading, or, safer bet, that they're all more or less illiterate.
That's pretty much his wager, plus hoping that his microscript will be illegible to them.
When he finishes The Drinker, which takes him a whole 2 weeks, he goes on to write a memoir titled A Stranger in My Own Country, for which he turns the pages upside down, writing in between the lines and crisscrossing them to make it that much more difficult to decipher.
Well, I take it that because we're able to read it, he manages to get all his writing out of the prison?
Yes. His belief in their aversion to the written word pays off. When he's allowed to leave to gather more material to finish the novel he claims he's been working on, he smuggles The Drinker and memoir out under his shirt.
It's crazy when you think how such a great novel could have easily been confiscated by the guards and never seen the light of day. This almost happened to the Sad with his 120 Days of Sodom. He'd hidden it inside the walls of the Bastille where he was imprisoned, and then, when it was stormed during the Revolution, he thought the manuscript was a goner. But of course, it was saved and finally published 100 or so years later.
Similarly, Genet lost at least 50 pages of his novel The Thief's Journal when a prison guard confiscated them. Lucky for him, or not, his sentence was long enough for him to rewrite them.
One of my favorite Argentinian writers, Antonio Di Benedetto, who wrote the great novel Sama, was imprisoned and tortured during the dictatorship in the 70s. The prison guards destroyed his writing, but allowed him to send letters. So he also turned to microscript in order to conceal his stories in letters to a friend. They did eventually get published, but I wonder how many great works of literature were tossed or burned by prison guards.
Well, losing the manuscript would have been the least of Falada's worries. Had they found The Drinker, they probably would have killed him for being a degenerate. But had they found the memoir, they probably would have killed not only him, but most of his family and friends for being enemies of the Third Reich.
You mean the memoir doesn't Heil Hitler?
No, the memoir is basically one part rant about how horrible the Nazis are and two parts self-justification for staying in Germany.
It's written with the belief that the war, the Third Reich, and the nightmare he, his country, and the world have been living through for the past decade plus will soon be over. He ends up being right about that. In about 6 months, Hitler will kill himself in his bunker and Nazi Germany will collapse. But what Falada doesn't foresee is that his worst nightmare, and a lifetime filled with them, is still yet to come. Next week, in our final episode of Little Man, What Now? The Life and Times of Hans Falada, we'll look at the hellscape that Falada inhabits in his final few years on Earth and chart his course from relentless desperation to a despair without return.
Penknife is created, written, and produced by Corey Eastwood, Ramona Stout, and me, Santiago Lemoine. Hans Falada is voiced by Finn Lobzin. The sound design, music, and all things audio are the work of Diego Sanchez of La Pianola Studio in Buenos Aires. The logo and all things visual have been made by Nelly Cuellar Torres. Flor Lopez built our website, penknifepodcast.com, where you can find a full bibliography of the works we used in researching this episode. And again, thanks to Elurbster for letting us turn his spare bedroom into a recording studio. If you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts, subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and tell your friends about the show. We're not going to lie to you. We've made these 3 seasons ourselves with very little financial support, and it's been a struggle. We really want to continue to make Penknife, but in order to do so, we need your likes and reviews. Even if you think it's shit and you just want to chime in to tell us to stop wasting our time and money making this podcast, we'd love to hear it.